It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. What's your name?
Noah, Liam, Mason, Jacob, Emma, Olivia. Sophie.
Your name was given to you with love when you were born. Over the course of your life, it'll become a kind of second skin, a collection of syllables that tells other people and you who you are. How can something so small mean something so big?
My name's Parth Shah, and I'm a reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Parth is my colleague here at WPR. He's a young reporter, just starting out, and he also hosts a podcast called Hyphen. He did an episode recently that got a lot of us thinking about the invisible stories that are hidden inside names.
Reporters at the station produce stories for newscasts that air during rush hour. Each story ends with what we in the business call a standard out cue.
Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I spent a fair amount of time my first few days in the job trying to figure out how I would say my name in my standard out cue. It was kind of like in middle school when I would practice my signature in the margins of my notes. My entire life, so school, college, and work, I've been Parth. Sometimes people have teased me and called me Fart or Barf, and sometimes I've been nicknamed things like Parthenon or my personal favorite, Parther, like Arthur, the character from PBS. But my name's different when I'm with my family. My parents don't call me Parth, they call me Barth. That subtle difference in the way the A is pronounced may seem slight, but Barth feels like a whole other side of me. My parents immigrated to the U.S. from India a year or so before I was born. I grew up speaking Gujarati at home and English the moment I left the door. While 9-year-old Parth was hell-bent on just eating pizza Lunchables and Go-Gurt for lunch, Barth would wreck a bowl of rajma for dinner, washed down with a tall glass of chas. I think names are fascinating. It's the first gift you ever receive long before you can even grasp the concept of what a gift even is. And it pretty much has a no-return policy on it. Your name is a combination of sounds used to set you apart. But what if your sounds are too hard for some people to say?
Hi, my name's Akshada Redkar, AKSHADARedKar.
Akshada Redkar is a senior at UW-Madison. Unlike most of her classmates, Akshada never just got to raise her hand and say present during class attendance.
They'll, like, give their best, but their best is, like, forgetting the middle part. And I'll be like, Akshada, Asada, and I'm just like, and then they'll be like, Redkar, and I'd be like, oh, that's me. Sometimes, I'm not gonna lie, it was just fun to hear them try and say it, just because I could feel their frustration, but I didn't really care, because I was frustrated on the other end.
What does Akshada mean?
I don't know. Oh my god! I don't know what my name means.
You don't know what your name means?
No. My mom told me when I was like little. Let me confirm. Hello? Oh, my Ali Ghari, mama. What does Akshada mean?
It's hey, Lakshmi. It's a goddess of prosperity.
To be fair, it's not surprising that Akshada can't define her name off the top of her head. No one calls her by her full name. She's always been AK or Ak. And even though most people don't call her Akshada, she says she likes her name. And she's long since come to terms with the struggles that come with it.
Have I wanted a name with my kitchen on it? Yes. Will I find one? No. But still, I could always just get the ones that say, like, I went to Florida, rather than, like, Lisa went to Florida or something.
I'll take a Moscow meal, too.
I got on the topic of names over after-work drinks with some friends who work at a local IT company. Meet Andrew Huang.
No one pronounces my last name right.
What have you gotten?
Last name?
Yeah.
Huang, Huang, Wang.
But your first name has been easy for people to pronounce.
Yeah, Andrew, which was, you know, pretty easy for people to get.
And is Andrew what's written on your, when the teacher's reading roll call, is that what's in the system?
Yeah, that was my first name.
Okay.
I don't think I didn't have the Chinese name until afterwards. My grandmother said she didn't want me with some bullshit capitalist name and then gave me my Chinese name, which is Huang Xinghai, which is Yellow Heart Ocean. So she called me, she said I had a big forehead. She said ocean because the forehead was as big as an ocean.
But no one really calls Andrew by his Chinese name.
Well, what's your identity? I mean, I've tried so hard to become American. Andrew is my American name. And usually, I don't really get any discrimination until they find out my last name. That's actually a part that, especially now with analysts and stuff like that, who only know my first name when they talk to me on the phone. They talk to me very differently once they know their my last name. They think I'm some fob, like, just fresh off the boat. They don't treat me as an American. And actually, it kind of insults me, you know? Because I grow up here, I'm treated as an outsider.
Hi, Mom. Kimcho. It also bothers me when I'm treated like an outsider. I was born and raised in the U.S., and while I didn't have a traditional American upbringing, my parents did what they could to make me feel included, even when it came to naming me.
Daddy liked Karan, the name Karan. But when you spelled Karan, it becomes Karen for here. So he showed to the nurse, and he asked her, how do you say it? Because that time we were already in U.S., and we knew how hard it is to everybody to pronounce the name. So then we decided Parth. And with your name, we didn't have to think too much because we had to give the name before we leave the hospital.
In India, babies aren't named the same day they're born. Families consult an astrologer and other relatives before they decide. That's how my sister Pranjali was named. She was born in India.
Well, I didn't realize that time that if I may name this, nobody can pronounce her name.
Pranjali is an uncommon name. While I've met dozens of other Parths in my life, I've never met another Pranjali.
I don't know. I feel like I say my name wrong, too. I feel like there should be an... I'm not saying it Indian enough. I don't say Pranjali. I say it's Pranjali. But I feel like it should be more enunciated, like Pranjali. Do you hear the difference?
Yeah, I hear the difference. I feel like that's the same with my name. I say Parth, but it's Parth.
Parth. Yeah, and I'm not trying to make it easier for anyone. I hate when people say, do you have a nickname? Sir, you just met me 5 minutes ago. We are no more than mere acquaintances. You can't shorten my name. I feel like it's respect to learn how to say my name correctly and try and attempt. And I really appreciate when people attempt it.
I mean, remember I would call you Prune Jelly and Pranjagorilla?
Pranjagorilla. A challenge I do face that now that I'm like a quote-unquote young professional and I'm learning how to network, it's really difficult having a hard name because I can remember, you know, Samuel Johnson with the blue eyes and who, you know, I can remember his name more and I can repeat that. But for someone to remember my name, I feel like I'm more forgettable.
Pranjali has always had people struggle with her name. To make things worse, she had a snot-nosed little brother who would get other kids in the neighborhood to call her Pranjagorilla and Prune Jelly. Even though children and marriage are not on the radar, I had to ask if she had given any thought to how she would name her future kids.
I can't even think what I'm having for dinner later, so it's just really tough for me to think that far. But I would love an Indian a name of Indian origin for my child.
Why?
Because that's who I am. That's who we are. That's the roots of generations and passing on a culture. I just feel like we have been so removed from the Indian culture just because we live here. A name bears so much meaning. If someone hears my name, they know I'm not from here, which isn't a great thing all the time, but it's something I could represent. It's like symbolic.
Names are symbolic. That's why naming a baby is such a huge deal. I remember reading a New York Times article a few years ago about the baby naming industry boom. There are books, websites, even paid consultants to help people choose the right name. In a way, my standard out cue is my baby. Getting to put my first news report on the air was the culmination of years of hard work. Ever since I was a kid, I dreamt of being on the radio, and here I am. My standard out cue should be symbolic. It marks the start of my first career. I've grown up a lot in the 5 years since I left my parents' home. I went to college, I got a degree, I moved to a different time zone for my first job. All of that happened with most people calling me Parth, not Barth. I remember sitting in the recording studio 7 months ago, the day my first story for Wisconsin Public Radio was set to air. I had finished voicing my report, and at the end, I voiced 5 or 6 different versions of my standard out cue. Here's the one I chose. Parth Shah, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That's Parth Shah. He's the host of Hyphen, a podcast about identity, and you can find it on iTunes or wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. Hey, Parth, the reason I liked your piece so much is because it sparked so many conversations, like here in the office and at home. It just seems like everybody relates, whether they have a hyphenated identity or not. Everybody has some story or some personal history having to do with their name.
And I'm curious about you as well, because your last name, Strainchamps, is unusual.
It's from Luxembourg. So my grandfather on my father's side immigrated here, came through Ellis Island. But my dad is an only child. And so as far as I know, my immediate family, my sister and I, we're the only Strainchampses in this country. It's kind of like being a member of an endangered species.
And do you like being a member of that endangered species?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about my name. I mean, it's, you know, I was teased about it a lot growing up. But on the other hand, by now, I kind of feel like, you know, I suffered for that name. But I used to collect misspellings for a while, you know, back when people still got letters.
What are some of the mispronunciations you've gotten?
Strange ham. And then one of my favorites was Strange Pants. And my favorite of all was, it's kind of beautiful, Strange Chance.
Yeah, it does have this magical tune to it. I had a fair share of mispronunciations, but my name actually in my community that I grew up in North Carolina, it wasn't an uncommon name actually. In my neighborhood, only 3 or 4 blocks down the street from me, there was another Parth Shah.
Who oh, really?
And he also had my middle name because we both are from the same, our families are from the same part of India, Gujarat, and people there typically, children get their father's name as their middle name. So his dad had the same name as my dad, and we both had the same PKS, Parth Kamlesh Shah. We shared that same name. And
I mean, did you like that or was it creepy?
No, I definitely did not like it. There was this kind of thing when you meet other Parths. When I meet other Parths, I almost like size them up. And it's so childish in a way. But I remember when I was growing up and we were in this small Indian community. And he's a great guy. Let me just put that out there for the record. But I remember having this like slight resentment for the fact that we shared this name, because your name is your identity. And when you have someone that is so closely connected to your circle that has your same name, you kind of feel small for it almost.
Mm. Well, that's a perfect connection to our next story, which is about what it's like to have a common name, a very popular name, which has its own sort of difficulties. So let's introduce Mike Michael Shackelford. And this is a guy who knows the pain of having a popular name.
In fourth grade, there were 3 Michaels in my class, and the teacher never through the whole year thought to address Michaels by their last name, like Michael S., Michael C., you know, what's the answer to number 14? No, it was always just Michael, and then there was a chorus of which one. And I remember my first job, not only was there another Michael, but there was another Michael S., so I became known as Michael S.H., and then that turned into a joke, like everyone would go, shh, Mike S.H. is coming, you better be quiet.
Okay, so he may have a common name, but because of it, he wound up doing something very uncommon. If you've ever seen one of those annual lists of the most popular baby names in the U.S., you can thank this guy, Mike Shackelford, because he invented the National Baby Name Register.
Well, as you know, my name is Michael, and Michael is, or should I say was, by far the most popular baby name when I was born in 1965, and it didn't give you any sense of individuality to have that name. So when I became an expectant father in 1997, I didn't want to pass on a really popular name to my child, but I didn't know what were the popular names were at the time. So I fortunately had a job with the Office of the Actuary at the Social Security Administration, and I had access to lots of very valuable Social Security data. So it was very easy for me to write a program to tabulate what were the most popular names. You know, it was probably a 25-line script. Execute it, wait for the results, bam, and there was the answer. And I knew that I was the first eyeballs to ever be seeing nationwide popularity lists.
Do you remember what the most popular baby names were?
Michael was still number one, and, you know, other ones like David and William, James, John were big. What I was totally surprised by what the popular girls' names were. They were names that I had barely even heard of.
Like what?
Emily, Jessica, Ashley, Sarah, Hannah, Samantha, Taylor, Alexis, Elizabeth, and Madison. Those names were not very popular for girls when I was born.
Well, no. I know we can actually check this, right? So you've got your computer. Can you go back to when you were born? What were the popular girl names?
Okay. Lisa, not surprisingly, Mary, Karen, Kimberly, Susan, Patricia, Donna, Linda, Cynthia, and Angela.
God, that takes me back. I mean, yes. You and I are about the same age. I remember sitting in classrooms, there were always like five Karens.
Yes, and tons of Lisas. It was just a sea of Lisas in the 60s, much like it was a sea of Jennifers in the 70s.
So you didn't just pull up the top 1,000 baby names for your year. You entered, if I understand it correctly, all that Social Security data, so you could wind up looking at the names across decades.
Yes. So the way it started is I tabulated this list, and somehow people found it, and I got a lot of media interest about it. And one day, I was interviewed on All Things Considered, and my boss at Social Security happened to be listening to it on his drive home from work, and he was really surprised that I was, shall we say, getting all this fame over something Social Security related. So he asked that I take down the list from my personal website, and we put it on the Social Security website, and immediately it became one of the most visited pages within the socialsecurity.gov website. And the people that ran the website called me and said, you know, Mike, you know, this website, the hits are out of control for it. So they started asking me to give them the updates on an annual basis. And I was enjoying the project, too, because sometimes I felt like as a government bean counter, my life didn't mean anything. But I definitely felt proud of this work.
Have you seen any trends over the past 50 years?
Well, since I started publishing my list, I'm proud to say that names have been changing in popularity more quickly, especially for the boy names. Girl names have always fallen in and out of popularity fairly quickly, but now the boys' names are too. Still not as much as the girl names, but yes, absolutely.
Suggesting somehow we prize more individuality or
we're
more fashion driven?
If I may toot my own horn, I think that with the publication of the popularity list, parents are more in tune to what's popular and giving that more thought when they choose a name. If you go to any bookstores, not that there are that many of them left anymore, there will be a whole bunch of books about baby names. And all of them are going to have lists of the most popular names, which all trace back to the Social Security data. So anyone picking up a baby name book, which I think most expectant parents do, are going to say, oh, here's what the most popular names are. And I think most of them are going to say, let's try to stay out of the top 10 or 20. So I would like to think that I had something to do with that.
What did you wind up naming your kids?
Nothing that would really impress you, to be perfectly honest with you. I have three kids, one boy and two girls. The boy was born in February 2002. And one name that both my wife and I did not find too objectionable was Aiden. And in the year 2000, Aiden, spelled with an A, was 114th in popularity, and spelled with an E, A-I-D-E-N, was 324th. So that was sufficiently low on the list for me to go with that. But then what happens, everyone was thinking this same thing at the same time, and by 2010, Aiden, spelled with an E, has risen to number 9th in popularity. So now my son is in classes with other Aidens and facing the same problem I do. So I totally blew it there.
Michael Shackelford created the annual list of the 1,000 most popular baby names back when he worked for the government. Today, he analyzes sports betting on his own website. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from Organic Valley, a co-op of family farms committed to the craft of sustainable organic farming. Organic Valley believes in producing food in a way that respects the earth, animals, and future generations. More at organicvalley.com.
It's 1927, and poised on an airfield in Brooklyn, New York, is one of the great pioneers, the forefathers of American aviation. Of course, I'm speaking about no one other than Charles A. Levine.
What's in a name? Well, if it's Charles A. Lindbergh, plenty. If it's Charles A. Levine, not so much. Lindbergh was, of course, the first pilot to cross the Atlantic. Levine was the first passenger. So why did history remember one Charles but forget the other? Anti-Semitism might have had something to do with it. Henry Sapoznik is here with a story about two airplanes, two songs, and two men named Charles.
Levine, whose parents had emigrated from Poland, had made his fortune selling war munitions wholesale. His big thing was airplanes, and he purchased an airplane from an amazing Italian immigrant named Giuseppe Balanca. The plane had recently made a successful endurance flight for more than the hours would have been needed to fly from New York to Paris. Over the course of planning for his flight, Levine was hiring and firing so many pilots he needed to have installed a revolving door in his office. One of the people who heard about this was Charles Lindbergh, and he approached Levine in his New York offices and asked to be the pilot of the plane. Levine, sensing Lindbergh's neediness, decided to treat him with disdain and basically said, "Well, I may hire you, I may not. You might be the pilot, you might not." And Lindbergh was so offended that he dropped the negotiations and went to an airplane builder to have them fashion something which would emulate the Balanca. One of the pilots was so incensed that he sued Levine. A court injunction then kept the plane stuck on the ground while Charles Lindbergh was then free to fly into Paris and the pages of history. Eventually, Levine ran out of suitable pilots for his plane and ended up lucking out with a corn-fed, Davenport, Iowa-born pilot named Clarence Chamberlain, who became really the man of the hour and made possible Levine's dream to fly across the Atlantic. There on the field, 2 weeks after Lindbergh, Chamberlain was revving up the plane when Levine, at the last moment, slipped in and became the first transatlantic passenger when the plane made it just this side of Berlin. The great thing about the excitement of this flight was that American popular entertainment and culture was incredibly taken with this. Newsreels, newspapers, and not the least of which, sound recordings. One of the recordings by a performer named Vernon Dalhart honored both of the pilots. Chamberlain and Lindy, our hats are off to you.
Chamberlain and Lindy, our hats are off to you. You're the kind of Yankees that win. One to Paris, one to Berlin, you made it.
It's basically a song that conflates the Aryan Chamberlain and Lindy, the kind of Yankees who always win, as the chorus say, leaving out conveniently the co-pilot or passenger, Charles A. Levine. Even though the mainstream recording companies only recorded songs about Lindbergh, ethnic Yiddish performers wrote songs about the Levine flight. Maybe the best one is a song that was co-written by a man named Sam Coslow. He wrote this really odd song, which has a Yiddish opening and an English section in the middle. The Yiddish verses were steeped in an almost kind of mythological, they say, great heroes of old, our great patriarchs of old, did wonderful things, but yet in our generation, we too have a great hero. So he's compared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob of the Bible. Oddly, the English section has nothing to do with the Yiddish section, and in fact makes use of stereotypes about Jews that were popular in vaudeville at the time. But it was stuff like this that would appeal to a crossover audience that really liked Jew comedy, as was seen on the vaudeville stage. So this is a record that was made for two different audiences, Jewish and not so Jewish, all in one piece. And that really, in a way, that's what the makeup of the flight. It had Chamberlain, the non-Jew, and Levine, the deep dish Jew. And so the song really reflected both of their backgrounds.
Levine, you're the greatest Hebrew ace. We got a thrill when Chamberlain flew, but you were right there too. We're proud of you, Levine, just an ordinary name, but you brought it everlasting fame. We welcome you home from over the foam, Levine, with your flying machine.
The weird thing about this story is we know the ending. We know that Lindbergh eventually became an America Firster, an isolationist who was a major endorser of what was going on in Germany in the few years after that flight. One of the ironic interactions which Lindbergh had was on his return to the United States, his victory lap that he took across the country, he and the Spirit of St. Louis, one of their stops was in Detroit, and one of the people he met there was industrialist Henry Ford. And Lindbergh gave Henry Ford a flight. The thing to keep in mind that 1927 was not just a triumph year for Lindbergh making the flight, it was also a major defeat for Henry Ford, who had recently lost a slander case about his anti-Semitic racist publication, The Dearborn Independent. So here were two men who had just had some weird interactions with a member of the Mosaic persuasion. Lindbergh having been thwarted in his efforts to get the plane that he wanted, and Ford was being forced to quit the publication of his newspaper. Both of them became big advocates of what was happening in Nazi Germany. Is it possible that this few-minute flight that the two men had solidified their anti-Semitism? I like to think so.
In Bruchessung Tool, wünsch dir dein Jesrul, Levine, mit dein flying machine.
Henry Sapoznik is the director of the Mehrend Institute for Yiddish Culture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The historic audio comes from the Mills Music Library and John Fabke at the Center for Popular Music at Middle Tennessee State University. Names are so complicated and so interesting. I mean, even the plainest name in the world, I don't know, Jane Smith, can carry all kinds of family history and baggage. Maybe Jane was named for a dead relative, and she's had to live with that ghost all her life. Maybe the ordinariness of her name has made her feel invisible. Canadian psychoanalyst Mavis Hymes has seen a lot of clients struggle to come to terms with their name, or discover new meaning in a name they took for granted. She writes about both in a book called The Power of Names.
The name is something that I would describe as a house in which we live. It's a house that we're given, and through our life, we make it our home, that we kind of appropriate it and make it our own. This name that we may not like, but more importantly, that brings with it a long tradition, a long history, perhaps, mm-hmm. the surname I'm speaking of here. And so there is coming to terms with one's family and one's heritage as well.
And this is the central thesis of your book, is that our names have much more power in our lives than we tend to realize.
Yes. We think of earlier centuries, then the surname really was tied to one's bloodline in a very concrete way. It represented land, it represented tradition, it was associated with a badge, a herald that said, you are such and such a person from this bloodline, and this is the way we have to behave. And we also live and die for this name. You know, wars were fought over names. Bloodlines had a lot to do with wars and territory. That shifted over the years, and that's not where we're living now. But there is trickling down through this notion of, you know, we carry this name, and in our family we do certain things.
Well, there's also there's also the notion that today a name confers a legal identity, and in that, so that's another form of power, right? You know, maybe it's not the power of the family you've inherited, but it's your connection to the power of the state.
It very much so. And we think of when you're stripped of that, thinking of the Nazis stripping the Jews of their identity during the Holocaust, that taking away their names and writing numbers on their forearms was a way of stripping them of their humanity as well.
Yeah. To be nameless is to be exiled from the human family, to be a non-person.
Exactly.
You have your own personal reason for getting interested in names, right? Because your interest began with your own family name, Himes, which is a shortened version of what the original family name was.
That's right. My surname was Himovich, and my father, who was one of nine siblings, he and his brothers, there were seven of them, decided to shorten, abbreviate the name in the 1940s in order to remove the ethnic Jewish-sounding element. So not unlike many immigrants, not only Jewish, and it still happens now.
When that happens, when people change their names in order to disguise their identity in some ways, do you think that people carry a sense of a hidden identity, a secret second self?
I absolutely do. Words, and particularly names, leave traces. And as a psychoanalyst, I believe in something called the unconscious, which means I believe that there are things over which we're not completely aware, things over which we have no control until we become a little more aware of them, but that things get registered, important psychic events get registered somewhere. For me personally, and it only something I became aware of later, those missing letters in my name from Himovich to Himes did have some impact on me. It suited me, but it also concealed something that it was important for me to acknowledge.
Well, it's interesting thinking about why some people choose to deliberately change their names. I mean, I'm thinking of famous examples like Prince, who became the artist formerly known as Prince, or, I mean, so many writers, Mark Twain, all kinds who've chosen
many
pen names.
Many. So certainly there are different categories of people who change their names. So there are people whose names, celebrities who want a name that's more sexy, that's more appealing. But then there are also those people who carry the psychological weight or burden of their name that's intolerable. And I can give you one could be psychological in a case where there's been sexual abuse or horrendous, horrific abuse. I've seen that clinically, where the only way to come to terms with one's past is to really make a cut and to change one's name. And then you have people who bear the names who are the children of someone like Lenin or Stalin or Hitler.
And you also wrote, you wrote about an Israeli filmmaker who made a documentary called Hitler's Children.
That's right. And all those people who whose fathers in particular carried out horrific crimes against humanity, who struggled with the weight of that name.
Yeah, growing up in Germany and your last name is Himmler or Göring.
Exactly. And even I met a gentleman at a bed and breakfast in Toronto who emigrated from Germany after the war, and his name had been Adolf, and he had to change that name.
Historically, haven't there been plenty of cultures in which there's an idea that your true name has power? and that you might have a secret true name known only to you or only to those you choose to share it with?
There are some cultures, so in Judaism, there's a notion that the name is so powerful and that there's something so essential about one's name. To know one's name is to know the essence of a person. That if someone is very sick, there's a ritual that's performed, that's a name-changing ritual, in order to fool the angel of death. So if I change, you know, my child's name from Susie to Mary, maybe I'll confuse the angel of death and she'll pass over. So there's a name change in that sense.
Yeah, you write about, you had a client, right, who told you that's what had happened to him?
Yeah, as someone I knew, in fact, that they had this secret name. And to this day, because it had that kind of power, he was reluctant to tell me what that name was. His name had been changed. Yes. And so, yes, traditionally, I mean, in mythology, to know the name of a god, I'm thinking of the Egyptian myth of Isis and Ra, the king Ra, and that Isis was trying to if she got to know the name of Ra, that would be to have his power, to take his power. And same in the biblical tradition, that to know the name of God was to know some, to have some of his power. That's why when Moses asked God, according to the Bible, when he said, I am who I am, he didn't give Moses his actual name. And so Jews are not allowed to pronounce the name. They say my Lord or the Eternal One. There are other names for God.
That makes me think that I was going to ask you, do you think everybody or most people feel ambivalent about their names?
I don't know. It's always conscious. Even if one likes one name, I mean, at one level, there are people who like their name, people who are not so crazy. I talked to many people who said, gee, I wish I had another name. You know, this is such a boring name, or this is such a this name, or that, whatever. But that's not the level at which the ambivalence is, because I think the ambivalence goes more to how the name was given, in what were the expectations and hopes? Did one live up to those? Can one, that's the sense of what I mean to inhabit one's name, to separate from one's parents, to really own one's name and to begin to speak in the name of, in one's own voice, without all of the weight of what was expected. So in that sense, it speaks to a kind of psychological birth of the person, you know, coming into one's own.
Mavis Himes is a psychoanalyst and the author of The Power of Names, Uncovering the Mystery of What We're Called. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There are not too many novelists who have an apple orchard out their back window. But Jane Hamilton does, because she lives on an apple farm that's been in her husband's family for generations. Jane is an award-winning writer. She's the author of The Book of Ruth, A Map of the World, and now she's got a new novel out called The Excellent Lombards. Now, this one is her most personal. It's a story of family inheritance and generational conflict, sat on an apple farm that's kind of like hers. On a recent spring morning, Steve Paulson set out to visit her there.
Jane Hamilton lives on a farm in the southeastern corner of Wisconsin. There are sheep and goats, lots of barn cats, and chickens right near the house.
So how many acres do you have here?
Let's see. I think it's about 260, and there's marsh and woodland. And so these are Ida Reds.
Jane and I are walking up a hill to an apple grove just past the farmhouse and an old, rather dilapidated barn. There's an ancient bathtub with claw feet sitting out in the middle of a sheep yard. It used to be in the house. This whole landscape of rolling hills is beautiful. A long time ago, a glacier stopped here and dumped its load of gravel. And the soil is perfect for these 17 acres of apples. Jane's husband, Bob Willard, is one of the partners who runs Ela Orchard. I've picked a windy day to visit.
This was an area that was settled in, 1848. My husband's ancestors came from New Hampshire and built a fanning mill company. And it has been reported that the old family house, which is in the village of Rochester, was a stop on the Underground Railroad. So it's rich in history.
Do you feel that? I mean, do you feel like you're somehow in touch with that history?
Yes. And the old house is still owned by the family, and there is a room in that house that has never been touched, and it's still the old parlor, and it's upstairs, and the horsehair sofas and the old portraits and newspapers from 1863 are still in bundles in that room, and it has a certain fragrance.
There is a lot of history around us. In the woods, Jane says, there's an old Indian marker tree that was bent into a dramatic S-curve to show the path. And there are also burial mounds on the property. The house where Jane and Bob live was built in 1860, though it now doesn't much resemble what the house used to look like.
When you go in the basement or even in the house, you can, again, this is about smell, you smell the... I won't call it mold. I'll call it the fragrance of the ages. But, you know, I'm the outlaw. I married into this family, so I have a certain anthropological bent in my feelings about the history.
And how did you end up here?
I went to Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota with my husband's cousin. And after college, I was thinking that I would go to New York City to have a job in publishing, and I stopped here to visit my Carleton friend, and it was August, and there was apple picking, and they were actually short-handed at that moment, so I stayed for a couple of weeks to pick apples, and then I stayed forever.
Jane says she was lucky in so many ways, not just meeting her husband here, but also landing in a place where she could develop as a writer with no one looking over her shoulder, without worrying, as she says, about missing the party in the big city.
Hey, Bob!
We spot her husband, Bob, examining some of his trees with a paring knife in his hand. Last night, there was a late spring frost, which could prove disastrous for this year's crop of apples.
Can't tell for sure. It may be a bit mixed, where I do see some apples that were destroyed, but I see other ones that look like probably they'll be okay.
Was this just from one night of frost?
One night, yes, about 4 hours. Sunday morning, 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. was when temperatures got down to about 26. Usually we worry when temperatures are below 28, there can be damage at this stage. When the blossoms are out and just when the very first little apples are forming.
When Jane first moved to the farm, she was heavily involved in the apple business, but once she and Bob had children, she started cutting back. And then when her writing career took off, Jane phased out of day-to-day operations on the farm. But still, she has strong opinions about what makes a great apple.
We have a variety called the Canadian Melba that is early apple. It comes in August, and it's a relative of the Macintosh. It bruises when you look at it. It's very difficult to pick. It doesn't store well. It's the best apple on the planet. Nobody really knows it because they're not shipped.
Jane Hamilton's written 7 novels. Her first, The Book of Ruth, was picked for Oprah's Book Club, and a couple have been adapted for film or television. Her new novel, The Excellent Lombards, is set on an apple farm that sounds a lot like her own place. It's the story of two cousins and their families who run an orchard. Back at the house, we sit down at a huge table. We're in an old farmhouse kitchen that's been updated with modern appliances, and on one wall there's a giant mural painted by a friend. Ever since I read the new book, there's one question I've been dying to ask. Just how autobiographical is it?
So Jane, this novel is about a lot of things. It's about a girl growing up, family relationships, running an apple orchard, and then the challenge of trying to hold on to a family farm when that's getting harder. How close to home are these issues for you?
Well, I had been thinking for a lot of years about the matters of succession because as one gets older, when you have a family business, and especially a farm, the matters that are so vexing with succession So who gets to stay, who can't stay, who stays but isn't equipped to stay, who stays but for whatever reason there might be other forces that make that person feel that they don't truly belong. So all of those questions and vexations are things that I wanted to put into the body of my heroine, Mary Frances. And are they real life problems and situations and matters in my life as a farmer's wife? Yes.
How would you describe Mary Frances, or Frankie as she's called by a lot of people, the heroine, the narrator of your book?
She's a girl who's growing up in the 80s and 90s, and this is before cell phones, and so she's marvelously free. She ranges through the course of the novel from age 5 to 17. She is so in love with her family, her father, her brother, mother, not quite so much, but she'll take the mother. She is in love with the apple orchard where she lives. She's even in love with the tensions between her father and her father's business partner. She's kind of thrilled by that drama. She wants never to grow up. So I would say she's a little deranged by love for her family and the whole situation.
So why did you want to tell the story from her point of view?
Well, I guess I would say that the child is always a compelling narrator to live with. There's that tension in the child, especially a high-spirited girl like Mary Frances, who feels powerful, but of course she's very vulnerable, and she knows that. And also, it's always a pleasure to look through the eyes of a child. Mary Frances is especially wrong about a lot of things, but also right about a lot of things. I was told, actually, that I should tell the story from the mother's point of view, which is more closely aligned, you would say, from my point of view. And I really did not want to do that. Having a child look at the world made it more possible to really enter the fictional realm.
And then Mary Frances, she desperately wants to hang on to this life, to the family farm and all that. She can't imagine a future where she doesn't live there. Her older brother, William, had shared that vision maybe early on. He starts to drift away. It's kind of heartbreaking.
I think growing up is heartbreaking often. And also, you know, I like to think that there's still, in this day and age of remarkable plots that we're thrilled by when we watch TV series, there's still room for the simpler tale of a girl who is made sorrowful by the passage of time.
You raised two children on your farm, your apple orchard. They're grown now, but have either of them wanted to stay in the family business?
I have a 31-year-old son and a 29-year-old daughter, and they are off leading their lives and doing interesting things, but they're very attached to the farm, and they want somehow to work out their lives so that they can be part of it in some capacity. So, you know, I always had hoped for them that they could stay if they wanted to, and if they didn't want to, they wouldn't have to stay. But that is all to be revealed.
Which is very much the case in your novel, too. Who knows whether the kids can stay on? Who knows who will inherit the family farm?
That's true. And, you know, even if they do, the question for them of succession will come up sooner than they realize.
There's a passage that in your book that gets to the sense of family mission in a way. It's sort of, you know, they're all in it together, and I'd love to have you read that.
The harvest was a wild living thing that you were trying to tame, while all the while it was dragging you behind, arms out, flailing in the chase. But here was the miracle. Despite the chaos, the lack of planning, the bad feeling between Sherwood and my father, there was also an overriding unity of purpose, a reverence for the family history, a love for the soil within the property lines. Despite Sherwood's and Jim's temperamental differences, the apples grew. They were harvested, thousands of bushels a year. On the golden and blue afternoons, the driveway filled with customers, whole families piling out of cars to taste and to decide, to load up their trunk with bushels of apples and pears, with cider and honey and knitting worsted from the sheep, and white packages of lamb chops and legs and shoulders. The Ukrainian women from the city liked the kidneys and tongues, and the Yugoslavs had to butcher the animals themselves in the back barn. There were plenty of people who felt, the minute they started down our long driveway, that they were returning to a bygone time. "Don't ever change a thing," they cried. "Don't fix that shed," they beseeched. "We love this orchard, you guys. It's real. It's special. It's..." They sometimes got teary. "Tracy, Lizzie, get in here once and take a whiff of the apple barn. Oh, Lord, the smell." Years before, those customers had come with their parents or their grandparents, and they were returning with their children. It was nature itself, nature at every level, that forced the Lombard operation to work.
Thank you. This is great.
Thank you, Steve. Do you have enough?
I do have enough, yeah.
You'll see for a little lunch.
Are you, you're not too rushed here?
No.
I'd love to.
Okay,
here.
That's Steve Paulson talking with Jane Hamilton at her family farm in Rochester, Wisconsin. Jane's new novel is called The Excellent Lombards. Thanks for listening today. I hope you heard something that mattered or that you'd like to share. Remember, there's always more in our podcast feed. You'll find us on iTunes or wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Parth Shaw produced this hour. He had help from Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and John Merfeld. Parth heads to NPR next for a Kroc Fellowship. We wish him all the luck in the world. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. We'll be back next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.